Welcome to Amped Up, Utility Insights, Trends, and Challenges. I'm your host, Melissa Parvis, CEO of Athena, a consultancy and workforce solutions provider operating in the power sector. In this podcast, we explore the changing landscape of US electric utilities with great minds and insightful conversations. With all the combined challenges of low growth and the transition to clean energy, I think we can all agree that the US transmission grid is in urgent need of modernization due to aging infrastructure and a growing demand for electricity. US transmission costs represent 24% of residential energy bills, a fact which segues nicely into today's episode, where we will discuss potential efficiencies in transmission spend. According to a report from RMI, spending has moved away from high-voltage regional lines to lower-voltage local projects. RMI argues that this is an inefficient way to expand the grid, both costlier with greater environmental and land use impacts. One of the writers of the report, Claire Wayner, joins me today for a discussion on the transmission spending dilemma, local versus regional planning. Claire graduated from Princeton University in 2022, where she read environmental engineering. While studying, Claire interned at FERC, which sparked a keen passion for transmission and interconnection policy and regulation. Since graduating, Claire has interned at the White House, assisting the Biden administration's goal to procure 100% carbon-free electricity. And now Claire works for RMI, a clean energy and climate nonprofit. Claire, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to have this discussion.
Yes, I think it's going to be a really interesting one. Claire, can you start by telling us a little bit more about the work that you're doing for RMI and RMI's mission?
Absolutely. So at RMI, I am on our carbon-free electricity program. And within that, I focus on expanding our grid, expanding and modernizing our grid to enable more clean energy and load growth and kind of help us tackle all of the varying challenges that the grid is facing today. And we've seen the consequences of a grid that isn't modernized, for example, Winter Storm Uri in Texas. So my focus is really on enabling the planning and permitting and deployment and construction of grid upgrades necessary to get our grid to the point where it can adapt as part of the clean energy transition while maintaining a reliable and affordable electricity supply.
Must be a very interesting job right now. Very topical.
Yes, and it's only accelerating given all of the parallel challenges we're facing.
Yes, absolutely. So let's start with where transmission planning fits into this mission and why it's so important.
Transmission and the grid is really the backbone of our society today and then also the energy transition. But it really is an issue that is bipartisan, nonpartisan. You know, at the end of the day, everyone wants a reliable, affordable supply of electricity. No one wants a blackout. And so that philosophy is how I approach a lot of my work, is ensuring reliability and affordability through the energy transition. Today, the grid that we have was built for a different generation mix. It was built for legacy fossil plants, and we're seeing a lot of those fossil plants retire, many for good reasons, to reduce local air pollution, as well as to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we're looking at challenges with deploying new clean generation, because a lot of that new generation, wind and solar, for instance, is located in different areas than where we had those fossil plants. And so inherently, you need to change the topology and the structure of the grid in order to enable that new generation, which is in a different physical location, to come onto the grid. And then in parallel to that, we're also seeing a huge amount of growth on the demand side. So I'm sure a lot of your listeners now have heard about data centers and AI. And then in addition to that, we're seeing load growth from electric vehicles, so vehicle electrification, building electrification from things like heat pumps. And so to accommodate all of that demand growth, which the U.S. has really not seen in decades, our power demand has been flat, if not declining, due to energy efficiency upgrades, which we should still pursue in parallel. But to accommodate that demand growth, we're also going to need to be upgrading and expanding the grid.
I'd love to get your thoughts on the idea that I hear from a lot of people, which is fossil plants really are a lot more reliable than renewable sources like solar and wind because of the weather limitations. I've heard a lot of conflicting ideas on that. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
It's a common talking point, and I think it's easy to point to solar and wind as being quote-unquote less reliable because of their increased dependence on weather systems. I think it's important to highlight that a lot of our fossil energy resources also have inherent limitations due to the weather, however. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the outages that we saw, for instance, in Texas during Winter Storm Uri were from gas plants, natural gas plants, because the gas pipelines froze due to the cold temperatures. It was difficult to get gas delivered. We also in the U.S. use gas for heating for a lot of our buildings still. And so that heating and electricity dynamic can actually make natural gas plants less reliable during cold weather events. And so it's a myth that fossil plants, you know, are completely independent of the weather. Fossil plants also depend on the weather for their operability. You know, every source of electricity can experience an outage or have something go wrong. And so that's why it's important that we have a generation mix that embraces a diverse set of resources of electricity. So yes, the wind will not always be blowing, the sun won't always be shining, but you know, very complex electricity system modeling, some of which I've done, some of which I've seen others do, shows that we can still get to relatively high penetrations of wind and solar before we see kind of challenges with running the grid, you know, upwards of 50% wind and solar. And then once you get past that halfway mark, you'll want to be looking at technologies like short-duration energy storage, long-duration energy storage, what we call clean firm, so technologies like geothermal or nuclear. And then that portfolio of technologies can enable reliability while also enabling zero greenhouse gas emissions.
There are some great points there. So going back to transmission, what is the difference between a local and a regional transmission project?
That's the backbone of the paper that we wrote. And most people really haven't heard of it. So to paint that distinction, regional transmission projects are planned at the regional level. And this definition and this discussion that we're having is specific to the United States, just to set that at the beginning. So in the U.S., FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, established regional transmission planning entities in Order 1000 back in 2011. And these regional transmission planning entities are responsible for planning the grid within their regional footprint. The reason why FERC established these is because of all of the challenges that I just laid out at the beginning of the episode. You know, load growth, trying to integrate new types of generation, there was a need for planning transmission beyond a single utility's footprint. Because prior to the creation of these regional transmission planning entities, most transmission was planned at the local level. So by the local level, that means limited to just one utility's footprint. So you can think each regional transmission planning entity is composed of multiple utilities. And the benefit of planning beyond a single utility's footprint is that you get increased regional efficiencies from, say, running a model and figuring out that you could get 20% cheaper power if you rely on a resource that your neighbor has and then build out the grid to connect you to your neighbor better. So you get those day-to-day efficiencies, but then you also get benefits, particularly during extreme weather events. And I won't keep citing Winter Storm Uri from Texas, but it is a great example because Texas has chosen to island its grid from the rest of the U.S., and we don't need to get into those reasons now, but they've chosen to do that. And as a result, we saw really bad rolling blackouts during Winter Storm Uri. If they had had increased connectivity to their neighbors, those blackouts likely would not have happened at such an extreme scale. And so that's the benefit of regional transmission planning, both day-to-day cost savings and then also enhanced reliability, reduced risk of outages during extreme weather events. And so regional transmission is planned by those regional transmission planning entities that FERC set up in Order 1000. They run a region-wide optimization model to identify what upgrades the grid is going to need to maintain reliability and reduce costs for consumers and meet state public policy. While local transmission is planned by the utility at the utility level. And what the last thing I'll note here is, even though FERC set up these regional planning entities, we are still seeing local transmission get planned and built by utilities within those regional planning entities. And the reason for that is that the regional planning entity takes that bird's eye view, looks at regional needs. Some local needs may still exist, and so they do need to both happen simultaneously. But what the paper gets at and what we'll discuss is there's been a big mismatch in recent years in terms of the amount invested in regional versus local transmission.
I see. So looking at the overall grid modernization needs between the aging infrastructure, the data centers you mentioned, electrification, what do you see as the most pressing priority for transmission planning at this very moment?
I would say the most pressing priority would be to plan more regional transmission, plan and get it built. Another landmark rulemaking that FERC recently ordered last year is Order 1920. And that order requires each regional transmission planning entity to start doing what we call long-term transmission planning. Because to date, a lot of transmission planning in the U.S. has been pretty short-term and somewhat reactive. So instead of looking ahead, say 20 years, and say, oh, here's where we think we're going to see new generation trying to join the grid, here's where we think we're going to see load growth, it's been very much like, oh, well, generation has been trying to get there for 10 years, maybe we should do something about it. And that sort of reactive short-term planning results in higher costs for consumers. It results in delayed interconnection time for new resources to join the grid. Some of your listeners may have heard about the U.S.'s interconnection queues, which are these wait lines for new resources to join the grid. They are now years long. The reason for that delay is because the U.S. has not been doing long-term proactive transmission planning. And so the top priority should be for each of these regional transmission planning entities to start thinking not just short-term, but long-term, not just reactively, but proactively. And making those investments now proactively in the grid can help us to reduce costs and wait times in the long-term.
Yeah. Mentioning FERC Order 1920, how do you think the current state of transmission regulation is helping or hindering those priorities?
I think that Order 1920 is a huge step forward. We have yet to see how it will play out, but we have kind of a hint at it, at what happens if it plays out well. So in MISO, which is the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, they are one of those regional transmission planning entities that I mentioned. They operate in the Midwest. They've been doing long-term regional transmission planning. So FERC's Order 1920 is kind of modeled after the MISO process. And MISO has seen huge benefits. They quantify the benefits with every portfolio of transmission that they approve to get built. They've shown that the portfolios that they've come up with have enabled significant amounts of new generation to join the grid. And so MISO still has its challenges with this model, but that kind of illustrates their process is called long-range transmission planning, or LRTP. MISO LRTP kind of illustrates what we have to look forward to from Order 1920. Now, I would say that there are still things that FERC should do to improve the state of transmission planning in the U.S. One example is interregional transmission planning. So currently, today, interregional planning is not mandatory, only interregional coordination. And as a result, we are missing out on a lot of potential efficiencies of exchanging more power, not just within transmission planning regions, but really between and among those regions. And continuing to expand the grid among the regions can kind of reduce the islanding of the regions and continue to reduce costs for consumers. And then another issue that I would say that FERC should be looking at now is local transmission and local transmission planning, which we talk about in the report.
Mm. So can you talk us through a little bit about how utilities maybe decided to shift to local projects?
We predominantly have seen that shift since FERC came out with Order 1000 in 2011.
Mm.
And a key hypothesis behind that is that local projects are easier for utilities to approve, to get approved and to get built. We in the report title actually call this the regulatory gap. So regional transmission projects have to be, you know, planned by the regional transmission planning entity. They have to go through a series of steps to get approved. There's a lot of oversight that goes into making sure that regional projects are the right projects. Local projects often don't receive any oversight on the state, regional, or federal level. So often, here's how a local project goes. It gets proposed by the utility to the regional transmission planning entity. The regional planning entity says, great, local transmission is not within our purview, so we're just going to make sure that your project doesn't break the grid. And it's the utility, so they probably aren't going to propose something that is going to break the grid. So they get a check from the regional planning entity. And then at the state level, often these local projects are exempted from receiving a permit at the state level. They might be below a certain voltage level that the state has established just to kind of ease the regulatory burden. But as a result, a lot of these projects are flying under the radar of state public utility commissions, or PUCs, which are these state government entities set up to regulate, among other things, transmission spending. And so often these local projects do not have to receive a permit at the state level because of those exemptions. Another example of an exemption is that it might be rebuilding existing infrastructure. A lot of local projects are just rebuilding aging infrastructure. That is often exempted from receiving a permit at the state level.
Oh, wow.
And at the federal level, FERC is the entity responsible for the rates for transmission. So transmission regulation is a complicated scene of multiple actors in the U.S. So the states issue a permit for the project often, except for many of these local projects, they get exempted. But then on the federal level, FERC is the one who sets the ultimate rates. So they set the rates for the transmission for what you as a consumer are going to pay. And FERC currently uses what is called a formula rate-making structure. And it was meant to streamline transmission rates, but it's resulted in a much more lax system of setting rates that doesn't have nearly as much oversight. So it's essentially, the formula rate-making structure allows the utility to submit a spreadsheet with a list of its annual expenses, not even on the project level. It can just say, this is how much we spent on, you know, these high-level categories. And then FERC typically approves those with some scrutiny, but because it's not on the project level, they don't really have an opportunity to say, hey, was this local project needed? And so as a result, you can easily get a local project approved at the regional level. You might not need to get a permit at the state level, and you're going to get the rate pretty much approved by FERC at the federal level. So if you're a business, if you're a utility, would you rather invest in a project, a regional project that is subject to more scrutiny, that is actually also open to competition? So FERC in Order 1000 opened up regional transmission to competition. So you might not even win the bid to build that project. Or would you rather invest in local transmission, which doesn't really need to receive approvals at these various levels and is not open to competition? Mm. You know, which investment decision are you going to make? And as a result, as we illustrate in our paper, this regulatory gap has really driven a huge rise in local transmission spending across the country. And this is a major issue because it's an indication that we as a country today are not planning transmission in the most efficient or cost-effective manner possible. So local transmission is, again, as I said earlier, limited to one utility's footprint. So you are not getting those efficiencies from planning across utility footprints, planning across the region, planning across different regions. And
that
throughout
makes a lot of sense.
Transition, yeah, we want to maintain affordability for consumers. And so if you're putting a lot of money into inefficient local transmission projects, then you just have less money available to spend on the good regional and interregional stuff. Or if you do, you're costing consumers a heck of a lot more.
Yes, that makes so much sense. I actually read in your report that there's this big misalignment between local and regional planning. And I thought that was really interesting. Would you mind breaking that down a little bit more into detail of what that actually means?
Yes. So as I alluded to, local projects at the regional planner level frequently just get a check mark for, quote unquote, not breaking the grid. And that disconnect means that utilities can propose pretty much any local projects they want. And then separately, the regional planning entity is looking at what the regional needs might be. And it's not like they're upgrading the same equipment multiple times, typically. Sometimes that happens, but typically they aren't doing stuff as blatant as that. But that disconnect means that we are missing potential efficiencies between the regional and local levels. And these efficiencies don't exist in every scenario. Not every local project can be upgraded to also meet regional needs, but sometimes it can. And that's a process known as right-sizing, where you take a local project or a lower voltage project and you upgrade it to also meet a regional need. So let's say you have an aging 138 kilovolt line and you need to replace it because it's getting old. But let's say that the regional planning entity also finds that there's some load growth in that area, maybe from another utility's footprint, that also needs to be addressed. And if they were to do the right sizing analysis, they might find that you could replace that aging line, but also maybe increase the voltage to 230 kV, or install a better conductor that has increased capacity or upgrade the substation as well. And so rather than rebuilding that line and then separately evaluating the regional need and maybe identifying a separate solution that costs more, maybe it uses more land, you can perform a right-sizing analysis to ensure that you're building the most efficient and cost-effective solution. Right now in the U.S., for the most part, that sort of analysis is not happening.
Mm.
So we're sinking a lot of money into these local projects without an understanding of whether we could, you know, also resolve and get at these regional efficiencies from upgrading local projects.
Have you ever heard of a situation or know of a situation where a non-incumbent utility wins a bid to build a regional transmission line in a location where the incumbent utility serves the area itself? Have you ever experienced the reality of that conflict of interest?
We've seen a fair bit of that today in a grid region that I specialize in, PJM, which is a regional planning entity that is located in the mid-Atlantic of the U.S. And we've seen a couple of non-incumbent projects get approved for being the most cost-efficient. They often use a lot of greenfield space because incumbent utilities are the ones who own the existing right-of-ways.
That makes sense.
Frequently, not always, but often those right-of-ways are owned by the incumbent. And, you know, as part of modernizing the grid, we are going to need some greenfield. that is a reality that I think we as a society need to get more accustomed to. But what doesn't give me faith in the process today is there's no evidence from PJM that there was any analysis done to, for instance, look at existing locally owned transmission infrastructure, which sometimes can be fairly high voltage. We know of local projects in PJM that are 345 kilovolts or a couple of 500. So those projects are not necessarily small scale. And so it would just, I think, give everyone more faith in the process if there was an understanding of whether Greenfield was given consideration as kind of the last option, you know, to reduce land use impacts and impacts on local residents. So I think that's kind of the motivation that I bring into this space in terms of planning efficiencies. It can also cost less as well. That's not to say that, you know, sometimes non-incumbents do innovate and come up with less expensive projects that can minimize land use and get the job done in a less costly manner. But I think it's just important that we are considering whether these existing right-of-ways can provide more efficient solutions, which often that right-sizing analysis is not happening, or if it is happening, there's no transparency around how it is happening.
Mm. Well, thank you for that whistle-stop tour of the current situation. That's really fascinating, a different point of view that I've not heard. Reading your report, I understand that you've come up with quite a few regulatory solutions that you think would better suit the situation. You've kind of alluded to the state regulations being too micro, the federal being too macro. What role do you see for the federal versus state regulators to play in resolving these inefficiencies?
I think first and foremost, the analysis needs to start being done at the regional level about whether these local projects can be right-sized to also meet regional needs. In the report, we call that sort of process, we call it regional-first planning. So currently, as I said, the paradigm is local projects are proposed and approved pretty separately from regional projects. What we would like to see is for each regional planning entity to instead, at the beginning of every planning cycle, invite utilities to submit their local needs and then have the regional planning entity look at whether those local needs can be met alongside regional needs in a more efficient manner. And then regional projects get planned in a way that simultaneously meets any needs that maybe coincide, and then local projects are still available to kind of clean up the remainder of needs after that right-sizing analysis is done.
Mm.
Not regional first. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to ask, what's your experience of the utility response to this concept of going more regional first? I imagine it's a little bit of a conflict of interest for them, but it kind of makes sense, you know?
Yes, I think the challenge is when you take a local project and make it regional, oftentimes, not always, but often, it would then need to be open to a competitive bid. And that is not appealing to an entity that was able to build a local project not subject to competition. And the debate about competition and transmission is ongoing, and there are many vested interests on both sides of that debate. I would say my interest is not necessarily in who builds it, but just making sure that it was the most efficient and cost-effective project at the end of the day. And currently, our regulatory system does not give me faith that we are identifying projects in such a manner. And so it's easier said than done, but I would hope that all the entities involved could understand that each of them is ideally going to get a piece of the pie. And focusing on these regional solutions are bigger slices of the pie that drive at those efficiencies and cost effectiveness.
Yeah. So I've heard in some areas of the country, there's no regional planning happening at all. Is that a correct assumption?
Yes. And on paper, the regional planning is happening, but the reality is that no regional project has ever come out of these particular regional planning entities. The areas of the country are areas that are not part of what is called a regional transmission organization, or an RTO. So in the U.S., a lot of the U.S. falls under the footprint of an RTO, and an RTO is a type of regional planning entity. An RTO also operates wholesale electricity markets in their footprint, so enabling cost efficiencies through regional buying and selling of electricity. However, neither FERC nor Congress ever made RTO membership mandatory. So RTOs were voluntarily formed in many areas of the country to get at those cost efficiencies from power sharing. But not all of the U.S. is in an RTO. The two areas of the U.S. that are not in an RTO are the Western U.S., minus California, and the Southeast. And in these two geographies, there are technically regional transmission planning entities, because FERC's Order 1000 applied to the entire U.S., but those regional transmission planning entities in the West and the Southeast have not planned a single regional project since their formation over a decade ago, which is very concerning, because those areas could definitely stand to benefit from more regional transmission and more power sharing. But because RTO membership is mandatory, or is not mandatory in the U.S., and FERC to date has not chosen to really enforce Order 1000 strictly in those regions, we've seen the utilities in the area be able to continue to pursue only local projects.
Right. So they don't really have much of a choice then.
Right. Or there's really so little oversight. There's so little oversight going on in those regions. And that's not to say there is definitely, I have heard, appetite from state regulators and other advocates in those non-RTO areas to expand regional transmission planning. So there is a lot of good, promising work going on. But to date, those two regions have not come up with a single regional transmission project. And that's not because those regional efficiencies don't exist. They definitely do. There have been third-party models that have shown they exist. It's because utilities in those areas are not interested in regional transmission because of a number of factors, which we've talked about. Perhaps it's open to competition. It might, open up the region to greater cost efficiencies, which could actually cause their, generation units to be less economic. There are a number of different factors that have played into that, but I think it's just an example of how, FERC regulation goes only as far as it is enforced. And so strict enforcement is critical to ensuring that a lot of these ideas that we've been talking about and orders that FERC has issued can actually play out into reality.
How widely aware do you believe transmission planning experts, the regulators, are of this regulatory gap?
I think that FERC has become increasingly aware of it. So right before the holidays, we actually saw a complaint filed by several consumer groups related to the regulatory gap. And they cite our report multiple times. FERC held a technical conference on this issue back in the fall of 2022. I've heard multiple FERC commissioners, current FERC commissioners, talk about this issue. So there's appetite there. I think there are just a lot of moving pieces at the federal level, so it'll be interesting to see how they take it up, if they take it up, when they take it up. And then at the state level, I think we have some state PUC commissioners who are really interested in this issue. And then there is definitely, though, a lot more education that needs to be done among many other state commissioners. But I would say that it's a growing area of interest, and it's very salient today because of the rising proportion of customer bills that we're seeing transmission and distribution make up. And, this is not to say we definitely need more transmission spending. as part of the energy transition, but we want to make sure that that spending is as efficient and effective as possible.
Absolutely. A complete necessity for where we're at today, really. So this is really a topic that, unless you get ahead of it now, it's going to happen probably. It's going to happen to you, right?
Well, yes. And I mean, we're kind of coming out with this report and highlighting this issue after it's already been growing and happening. But, you know, the longer we let the regulatory gap exist, the greater potential for inefficiency to continue to happen.
For those who aren't familiar with your report, Claire, I'd love if you could go into a little bit more detail into some of the other solutions that you've mentioned.
Absolutely. So I mentioned the regional first planning recommendation, and that could be implemented by FERC or by regional planning entities. We also talk about the importance for transparency on local project data and spending. And this is an issue that I think a lot of advocates in different regions have run into, is currently utilities are not necessarily required to disclose a lot of information about these local projects. And so in the report, we talk about the importance of greater data transparency, ideally publishing that at the regional level, and greater transparency into whether right-sizing was considered for these projects, factors like that. A couple tweaks at the federal level, I talked earlier in the episode about formula rate making and how FERC's current rate making structure is pretty high level. And so in the report, we recommend that FERC consider making only projects that have received a robust review at the regional level eligible for formula rates. And for projects that have not been reviewed at the regional and or state level, those projects should not be able to just get a check from FERC. Those should be exempted from the formula rate structure, and they should have to submit more documentation to FERC, because, you know, so at least one regulator needs to look at these projects. So we talk about that being a potential solution at the federal level. And then at the state level, I did talk about how many states exempt these local projects from receiving permits. And so some recommendations we have are for states to re-examine those exemptions, to perhaps adjust those exemptions downward, or, you know, maybe a rebuild of an existing project doesn't need to get a complete, a full permit, maybe not one as robust as a new project, because you aren't, you know, creating a greenfield line, you aren't necessarily having the same siting concerns, but still having it maybe come before the commission, the state commission, for an expedited permit or some sort of review, rather than having it not have to get any review from the state PUC, which is how it currently happens.
Where can listeners learn more about these issues? It's been a really interesting, insightful session. I really appreciate it.
Definitely go to our website and download our report. We also had a really insightful webinar on the report with three amazing panelists. So definitely recommend that. Recording of the webinar is on our website as well. So if you want to dive even deeper into this or get some guest perspectives, I recommend listening to that. And then keep an eye on what FERC is doing on this. As I said, there was that consumer complaint filed right before the holidays. So ideally, we'll see some action from FERC on this issue in the near future.
That's excellent. Thank you, Claire. And just for listeners listening, what is your RMI's website?
It's rmi.org.
Great. And I'll post the link as well below and the link to the webinar as well for ease of reference.
Great.
So thank you so much, Claire. It's been excellent having you on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Amped Up. If you like this conversation, please support this content. Subscribe and rate the show on YouTube, Apple Podcast, or Spotify.